Hey everybody, Simon Rettner here. Welcome to The Checkout. Produced at the world's greatest jazz public radio station, supported by our listeners, WBGO 88.3 FM in Newark. Good Times, this iconic track written by the one and only Nile Rodgers in 1979 from his album Risqué, and then shortly thereafter sampled by the Sugar Hill Gang on Rapper's Delight, and then sampled a million times over, becoming one of the most bedrock tracks in modern music. Well, today we have a very special podcast to bring you from the North Sea Jazz Festival featuring the legendary Nile Rodgers, the man behind so many of the songs that we have enjoyed and listened to in the last 50 years, from David Bowie to Madonna to Diana Ross and Mick Jagger. Before we bring you that conversation with the Grammy award-winning writer and author Ashley Kahn, these are good times at WBGO. We want to keep it that way. This can be done by you, our loyal and fabulous listeners. We are in the middle of our pledge drive. We're asking for your financial support right now. We don't do this very often, but now is the time to keep great programs and podcasts like this one, The Checkout, on the air and on the web. So if you're feeling good with WBGO and The Checkout, you can become a member for only $5 a month, or sign up and become one of our sustaining members. If you opt to be a sustaining member, you can have your monthly support of WBGO renewed automatically. You can change or stop at any time too. It's just one less thing to worry about each year, and it keeps your music and WBGO thriving. So feel free to support us and give as much as you want. Make it automatic by calling 1-800-499-9246. That's 1-800-499-9246. Our lovely volunteers are standing by right now. I hope you can talk to one of them. Or do it on the web at wbgo.org/support, where you can contribute securely from anywhere in the world. I know we have a worldwide audience for The Checkout. You can even text your contribution to WBGO, 56512. That's 56512, your text, to make a contribution to this amazing public radio station. So we're going to keep the good times and good vibes coming to you for many amazing years to come. Today is a big day for Nile Rodgers and Chic, because today they are releasing a brand new recording called It's About Time. Nile Rodgers and Chic celebrating when the band was founded in 1976 with Bernard Edwards. Let's listen to a little bit of this music right now. This is called State of Mind, featuring Philippe Sais. with this new album featuring Chic and Nile Rodgers. He has some incredible stories to tell, as you're about to hear. You probably know his trailblazing work in disco and as a producer behind some of 20th century's most enduring pop songs. But did you know that Rodgers actually started out as a jazz musician? Well, last summer at the North Sea Jazz Festival in the Netherlands, author Ashley Kahn sat down with the formidable bassist, composer, arranger, producer to reflect on his jazz roots. We bring you that conversation now.
For the next 45 minutes, we'll be talking to a man whose impact on popular music, and I mean pop and dance, rock and R&B, hip-hop, electronica, is still being felt today. As co-leader of the band Chic, as producer with David Bowie, Mick Jagger, Diana Ross, and so many others, and most recently has collaborated with today's biggest stars like Daft Punk and Pharrell, his musical conceptions have never lost their relevancy, and he's not slowing down. Please welcome a man still in the middle of an amazing career in life, Nile Rodgers.
Thank you.
Nile, thank you. Thanks for making the time. You know, I was thinking that most interviews kind of end with that question about, so what's the most valuable lesson in life and that you want to share with, young musicians or young producers that you've had? And I thought, rather than wait to the end, just,
You'll start with the thing that I never do.
Okay.
Which is I never give advice, because my career has been incredibly successful because I've always done the wrong thing. I've always done what people said you can't possibly do, which is mainly because I love what I do so much. I don't mind failing. I don't mind taking a chance, because the job is actually the most fun part of it. You never mentioned my symphonic work. I mean, I've done films and video games, and I conduct big symphony orchestras. I just conducted the first movement of Scheherazade a couple of weeks ago at Abbey Road. I'm the new chief creative advisor at Abbey Road. So I started with classical music, so that really is one of my true loves. So.
Well, it's nice to get back to that. You started with classical music.
Absolutely.
You went to jazz.
Went to jazz.
And so that was...
And then went to Sesame Street, Rubber Ducky.
Does everybody here know Sesame Street? Children's
of course they
television?
Do.
Okay. All right. All right.
We grew up with it.
You know, guys, I'm going to give you all homework, okay? If you're not aware of a book called Le Freak, which is the autobiography written by Nile Rodgers, it is one of the most information, story-filled pieces of work coming out of a musician's career that I've ever read.
What's great is that you're right in the neighborhood where I was born and raised. So NYU University is in the heart of Greenwich Village, and that's my parents were beatniks, and people like Thelonious Monk would come to our house regularly, and Nina Simone and Gloria Lynn, and my house was sort of a hotbed of, bebop, what we used to call modern jazz back in the day. So it was just an amazing life that I had, and it just was the foundation for what I was to become. I had no idea.
The stories you talk about, and it's very confessional, very honest and straightforward, and you talk about, your special relationship with Bernard Edwards.
Yeah.
And how he kind of taught you about the idea of different styles of music and not to be a jazz nerd.
Well, actually, it was my teacher, Ted Dunbar, who taught me to not be a jazz nerd. He, in order to make a living playing music, I would do what we call pickup gigs. And they basically paid about $15 a night, which was the going rate. But I used to love it when we would get that phone call and we would negotiate like we were going to get more money. You never got more money, but it was, you tried to pretend like you were a professional. Hey, my man, we're doing a gig tonight, yeah? What's it paying? It's $15. They used to call it 15 cents. It's 15 center. Well, let me think about it. Now, you know you're going to say yes. If he said $10, I would have said yes. But so what happened was, what the story he's referring to is my jazz guitar teacher was amazing. He wound up replacing John McLaughlin in the Tony Williams lifetime before Alan Holdsworth came in. His name was Ted Dunbar, and he was great. Billy Taylor, I mean, he was a genius. So one day I was doing a gig, and he noticed that I had a sort of sour look on my face. And he said, "Hey, Niall, what's wrong, man?" You know, he was cool. "My man, what's wrong?" And I said, "Well, you know, I'm doing a R&B boogaloo gig tonight." He says, "What do you mean a gig?" I said, "Well, you know, we got to play top 40 because I want to do a straight-ahead gig." He says, "Wait a minute, I don't understand, but what makes it bullshit?" And I said, "Well, I have to play the songs that are in the top 40. And I specifically referenced a song called Sugar Sugar by the Archies. And I said, you know, that's on our set list tonight." And he says, "But what's wrong with Sugar Sugar?" I says, "Well, it's corny, it's bubblegum." He says, "Niall, what makes you believe that you're the ultimate consumer?" So millions and millions and millions of people love Sugar Sugar, but you think that you have this opinion that is better than theirs. And I looked at him, I was befuddled because he's nothing but a straight-ahead jazz guy. And he said, "I just want to tell you something. Every single song that makes it into the top 40 is a great composition." I said, "You call Sugar Sugar a great composition?" I said, "Sugar, do, 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 oh, honey, honey." Yeah, we'll get down. "You are my candy girl." I guess you prove his point.
Right.
So I said, "You call that a great composition?" He said, "Absolutely." I said, "Why the hell would you call that a great composition?" He said, "Because it speaks to the souls of a million strangers." And I went, "Oh my God." 2 weeks later, I wrote a song that went, "Everybody dance. Clap your hands. Clap your hands."
Everybody dance. Nice.
My first hit record.
And one of the most amazing bass lines of all time. Bernard, and you know how important he was to your stepping up.
So I met Bernard when I was doing the Sesame Street gig, and I went from Sesame Street to the Apollo Theater in New York, and the Apollo Theater was just amazing. I got to play with everybody from Screamin' Jay Hawkins to Roberta Flack to Aretha Franklin. King Kurt, I mean, everybody. So many people I can't even remember because it was a review format. And typically, most of the artists we played with just were one-hit wonders. So they'd had like one or two songs, but you had to put on a whole show. So it was just like two or three songs by that act, two or three songs by the next act. So I met Bernard doing a 15-cent pickup gig. And I was a last-minute stand-in because my friend got a job paying $25. So he took the $25 job and gave me the $15 job. We got there, and the leader of the band was a trumpet player who used to be in Joe Simon's band. I don't know if you know Joe Simon, but he was a really popular R&B artist for a while. And this guy's name was Hack Bartholomew. So he knew how to put on a show. But the band, none of us knew each other. So Bernard and myself sort of took the lead position because we figured if we'd impress this guy, he'd call us again and maybe give us $20 the next time. So we whipped these people that we didn't know into shape, and we made a coherent band so the guy Hack out front could put on a real show. After our very first show together, I said to myself, I never want to do another show without this guy playing bass. And I walked over to him and I told him that. He said, I was thinking the same thing about you. Now, but wait a minute, no, that's not the punchline. Here's the punchline. About 3 weeks before that, I live with my girlfriend. I ran away from home around 14 years old. Don't get any ideas. That's why I don't give any advice. I ran away from home when I was around 14 years old. I was living with my girlfriend at the time. So now I was around 16, 17. And her mother worked at the post office. And I was putting together a band. And I used to be a real hippie. I, like, see her hair that's pink? Well, she has, like... And nowadays, you guys have sophisticated way of coloring your hair. In the old days, we would just buy food coloring. Like, you know, if you wanted to have a cupcake and make it green, you'd put this vegetable dye in it. So I would put the vegetable dye in my fro and leave it in there for like 2 or 3 days. And then you come out, and it would almost look green. Like if the sun hit you right, I'd have a green afro. So I was this super hippie. And the same way my parents spoke in a sort of bebop language, I had this hippie speak. So my girlfriend's mom said, you know, there's this cat at the post office, and he plays bass. And I know you're trying to put a band together, and I think you guys should meet. So she gave me his phone number. I called him up, and I said, hey, man, you know, like, I'm putting together a band, man, you know, and it's like a cross between Fairport Convention, like Jefferson Airplane, maybe like a little bit of Hendrix thrown in, meets Mahavishnu Orchestra, maybe Dave Holland, man, you know, like that kind of thing, man. And Bernard was a soul brother. He was like, what the, like, this is exactly how the conversation went. After I described him the band that I wanted to put together, he went, yo, my man, lose my number. Click, and hung up the phone on me. This is the same guy that I ran into 3 weeks later. Now, how do I know this? Because now he and I, once we did that first gig, we became inseparable. I never didn't want to be without him. So now we're riding on the subway because we actually just lived one block away from each other. So we're riding on the subway. My girlfriend's mom gets on the subway and she's walking towards me and I'm thinking she's going to say hello to me. She walks past me and goes to Bernard and says, so I see you cats finally hooked up together. And he looks at me and went, that was you? And I went, yeah, man, you know, that was me, man. You know, like Country Joe and the Fish, man, you know, Jefferson Airplane, that's my... Anyway, so Bernard told me, he said, you know, with your in-depth knowledge of harmony and jazz and classical music, you know, we could put together our own self-contained band and we could do all our own orchestrations because this is when disco was starting to happen. And a lot of my favorite jazz artists were getting hit records, like Roy Ayers, Norman Connors, Joe Beck had What a Difference a Day Makes with Esther. And I mean, so I was like going, wait a minute. Oh, and Herbie Mann had Hijack. So we're like, damn, jazz people are getting hit records. So we thought we would do the same thing, except because I was an orchestrator, we could do the full Barry White thing, but we were from New York City, so we didn't want to be like gospel or like blues bass. We figured we'd be sort of European modal bass music. So we called ourselves Chic, completely by accident. We actually were called the Big Apple Band because we were, you know, we're from New York City, and we were actually the backup band for a group called New York City. We had a hit record that went, I'm doing fine now, without you, baby. So that was New York City and the Big Apple Band. Well, a friend of mine that I went to school with named Walter Murphy covered Beethoven's Fifth, and he called it A Fifth of Beethoven. and it was this big disco hit record, and everybody thought it was us. So they were like, oh man, you guys finally got a hit record. The Big Apple Band's got a hit record. We're like, no, that's not us. So we changed our names to Chic and pretended like we were from France. Because in America, the racism was so strong that if you were a black band, you could only get played on the black radio station. So we figured if we pretended to be French and didn't put ourselves on the cover, oh, right, I had seen this band called Roxy Music, right? And they had, like, models on the, this was, they were coining the term supermodel. And at that time, nobody knew any models' names except for one, Twiggy. Twiggy was the only model who, like, we knew her name. And then after that, there came models that we knew their names. And Brian Ferry had them on his cover. And we were like, damn, well, let's do the black version of that. And we got supermodels, put them on the cover. Right, so I have a new album. And we're paying homage to the beginning of Chic.
It's about time.
Right, it's about time. So anyway, everything we did was sort of like this crazy accident. We'd come up with an idea that people would say, you gotta be out of your mind. And we'd do it, and it was all about the music. At the end of the day, it wasn't about the really great story. That just got people interested. What was really cool was, I want your love, I want your love. You know, and also having the greatest musicians in the world on our records. We had everybody from John Faddis to the Brecker Brothers to Gloria Agostini, the first, I mean, like, we, the New York Philharmonic, these are all people I went to school with. So we would get them on our records for no money, and that's how we became Chic.
Yeah, that's great.
Squeeze it tight. I think of you, and I dream of you.
How real and bad your love I need. I'll need you.
Want Your Love, a Nile Rodgers classic, arranged on his brand new recording, It's About Time, featuring Lady Gaga. It's About Time is out today. The Grammy Award-winning author Ashley Kahn speaks to Nile Rodgers at the 2018 North Sea Jazz Festival in the Netherlands.
The picture you paint of New York in the 1970s, in financial ruin, but still the party's going on. Oh. The black and white divide, and yet black music and white music is coming together. And you're listening to not only Roxy Music, but Kiss.
Oh, so the concept was, so when we decided to do the black version of the Roxy Music thing, we noticed that anonymity was really, really cool. To be able to walk down the street and have a big hit record and nobody bother you was amazing to us. That was like, wow, because we really thought our stuff was going to be hot, right? Like we had no idea, but you got to believe. We actually made a death pact. Like, if this doesn't work, we're going to hold hands and jump off. I don't know if we would have done it, but we were believing it at the time, you know? So thank God the first record was a hit. Because I don't know if he would have called me on it. All right, bro, let's hold hands. Well, I just bought these new shoes. I can't, you know, I don't want to get them wet in the Hudson River. So we now had the concept. So we went out to hire musicians like the Magnificent Seven, right? Now we have the concept. So we have to figure out who fits in. So they couldn't be people that were known, or else people were going, wait a minute, that's just Luther Vandross, that's just Diva Gray. So we actually had to go looking for people that were unknowns. The first person we hired was a drummer named Tony Thompson. He was the drummer with LaBelle, and LaBelle were already into fantasy fusion, so no one really knew what they looked like because they were all like costumey. So Tony was perfect. He got into it. He was like, okay, I'm down. Second person we hired was a keyboard player, and he was friends with this group called Kiss. So he said, man, you got to see my friends play. And we went to see these guys, and they were out, they dressed up in white face makeup, and they had a fan base, and they had no record deal. So we went to see them. People were like going crazy. Like, they knew every song, and they were like, Kiss, Kiss, Kiss. And they had this whole thing with the band. And as soon as they took off their makeup, they'd come and sit out and they were talking to us. Nobody had any idea who they were. So I'm sitting there with Ace Frehley and we're talking and we're like going, and I'm like, this is amazing. So we thought that the equivalent of the white face makeup, you know, with black, we couldn't go, we were like America was tough enough, right? We weren't gonna push the boundaries that far. But what we decided to do were all the R&B and funk bands wore costumes. Even the Jackson 5, they all had these costumes that were made. We decided we were going to go to fashion designers. Since we had supermodels, why not go to fashion designers? So we wrote the song for Sister Sledge, and it was the first time anybody ever name-checked fashion designers. We went Halston, Gucci, Fiorucci.
That man is dressed to kill.
Oh, what the world? He's the greatest dancer.
And we got into it. We started to believe in our bull. We were making it all up. And but somehow it stuck because this new audience, which were what we call the black urban professionals. This was the audience from whence President Obama was spawned, Oprah Winfrey. It was very upwardly mobile blacks working on Wall Street. And we were thinking, well, that's going to be our audience. We weren't going to try and compete with Parliament Funkadelic. We're going to go the other way. We lived in New York, and this club called Studio 54 opened exactly a few months right before us, and we became the darlings of that crowd. And somehow...
But not right away, right?
No. Well, my girlfriend at the time had just graduated from Fashion Institute of Technology. So as long as I was with her, I could get in. What happened was Grace Jones invited me and Bernard to come because she loved this song, Everybody Dance. And she thought that we would be the perfect producers that would do her then next album, or what would have then been her next album. But we didn't know Grace Jones. We knew her music, but we didn't know the person. So we only spoke to her once. Does anyone know Grace Jones's speaking voice? So we thought that it was like Van Halen, like, you know, you remove the brown M&Ms or something. She's on the phone. She says, okay, so darling, see what, here's what you do. Is you go to the back door and you tell them your personal friends are Miss Grace Jones. And then you tell them that's who you are and they let you in. So we knocked on the back door and we went, hello, we are personal friends of Miss Grace Jones. And the guy slams the door in our faces, oh, f*** off. And we said, no. And we thought we got the accent wrong. And we tried it again. So we were like, in our heads, we were thinking that this was a cross between Marlena Dietrich, Bela Lugosi, and Bob Marley. We were trying to get it right. You know, we're knocking on the door, which had to be louder than the volume of the music inside. We are personal friends of Miss Grace Jones. We didn't know. Now that Grace is one of my best friends in the world, she is the latest person in the world. If Grace says she's coming at midnight, that means 4 a.m. or 3 a.m. We were trying to be professional and get there like a couple of hours before and show her that, of course, we're the right producers for you. She hadn't even gotten there yet, so there was no guest list. We realized we weren't going to get in that particular night. So we were going to my apartment, which was only one block away from Studio 54. We passed a liquor store, and we picked up two bottles of what we used to call rock and roll mouthwash, which was Dom Perignon. So we got a couple of bottles of rock and roll mouthwash, downed it. We were now feeling pretty fly.
Good.
And so we started going, off. Off, because that's what the doorman told us. That was our last memory. Aw, off, Studio 54. Off, and we thought of every possible scenario where the appropriate answer would be off. If a cab driver cuts you, boom. My partner looks at me and goes, my man, you know this shit is happening. This is 2 years before hip-hop, right? We can't get off on the radio. So, you know, I went back to my hippie thing, and I went, oh, man, you know, like, you know, when you have a bad trip, man, you know, you drop acid, you know, and you like, freak out. Maybe we should call it freak out, man. And he looked at me and went, what the, what? And I went, oh, I caught myself. I was like, oh, no, you know, brother, you know, when you dance with a fly chicken, you're on the floor, and you're freaking out. And then Bernard went, oh, my God. And then there's that new dance called The Freak that my kids are doing. Boom. Idea. So we got the idea we would write a song about this dance that we didn't know how to do. So we went out to the record store. We bought a copy of Chubby Checker, Come On Baby, Let's Do It, The Twist, and Joey D and the Starlighters, The Peppermint Twist. And both songs talked about these dances, but they never really taught you how to do them. They just talked about it. So they go, we got a new dance, and it goes like this. The dance don't go, that's a song. But, you know, so we go, you know, we talk about this. Have you heard about the new dance craze? Listen to us. I'm sure you'll be amazed. Big fun to be had by everyone. Anyway, we go, just come on down the 54, find your spot out on the floor, or freak out. And then we go, allow us, we'll show you the way. And of course, we don't show you the way because we don't know how to do it. And we just go, aw, freak out. So when we were doing that song, we had written the chorus and we were jamming, we were recording it. And believe it or not, I don't know why Bernard Edwards went, let's go, le freak, say chic. Which didn't even mean anything to us. It just meant the dance is cool. But it worked.
In French.
And what was cool is that because our pronunciation was so bad, right? You imagine we have Luther Vandross and we have all these people from down south. Everybody's from different neighborhoods all trying to say, le freak, say chic. And it just comes out as this thing. So most people in African... French-speaking African countries thought we were going Africa, to L'Afrique, Seriously. I meet people to this very day, and they walk up to me and go, oh, Africa! You love Africa! Africa!
Africa!
And it was because everybody had a different interpretation. Everybody kept saying, you know, like l'argent, like money, like le flic, c'est chic, like, you know, or like the police. We were like, oh, we don't know what you're talking about. You know, le flic, the police. That's a funny song. That's fantastic. Fantastic, c'est fantastic. We didn't know anything. It's like, no, my girlfriend was from Belgium. She speaks French. I don't speak French. This is bull. We're making it up.
But it worked.
But because we believed, that's the only advice I will give you, is if you're doing something and you feel it in your heart, believe in it and just do it, and do it like you mean it.
One last question for you. One of my favorite quotes from the book, Le Freak, is this idea of the song is the excuse for the chorus.
Yes.
And the chorus, I mean, talk about a timeless bit of advice.
Is the excuse for the breakdown. So our concept, when we put Chic together, we're an R&B band. And in those days, when you're doing an R&B performance, especially if you only got one song or two songs, you got to stretch it out. So the band would always break down, and the lead singer would go, let me talk to the ladies. It was all bull. Let me talk
Stagecraft.
To the ladies, right? So the band is grooving. So check this out. When my very first show at the Apollo Theater, I was playing Betty Wright, Cleanup Woman. And so she did the same thing. So I'm out there playing. Break it all down, bam. Now I know there's a lot of cleanup women out there, but I want to talk to some of you cleanup men. And she went on. The chart was like 13 pages long. Like letter J, letter K, cleanup men. We go, fuck. Cleanup. I'm like going, okay, so this was an R&B device, if you will. So what we did was we incorporated this R&B device into our compositions. And we figured that if it worked live, maybe it worked on the records. Because the one thing that we noticed, and I'm going to tell you something that is a fact, and you may not believe it, but this is a fact. In the old days, I'm 65 years old, so I'm probably older than a lot of you. But in the old days, when you went to hear a live show, basically, what you were going to hear was new music, even if it were a group as famous as the Jackson 5, because they were practicing the stuff that they were going to put on the next record, and they were trying to see how the audience responded. So that's what the show was. It was 40, 50, 60% new songs, and then you'd hear something famous, ding, 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 ba-do-do-do-do-do, woo, and then you go crazy. But we studied. We would watch new music and would like vibe off it the same as like a hit. So with Chic, that was our whole concept, and it's our concept to this very day. Our albums are our new show, and it's supposed to be a song you don't know. And we're hoping that the damn thing is so good that you sit there and hear it for the first time and go, damn, I want to hear that song again. But that's the thing, is that so I always believe in the concept of a live show is a real performance, and that's what we live for. The record is just, no, the record is just a snapshot of what we would actually do on stage. So if you come and see us, you'll see what I'm talking about.
There you have it. On the Nile stage.
Oh, on the Nile stage, which is...
all too appropriate.
How coincidental. Anyway, I'd love to
Someone's
take a question.
Someone's planning this, I'm sure.
Yeah, let's take a question, because I got
to
roll.
Just wait for the microphone to come to you.
So what can we expect today? Because Earth and Fire is here. Are you going to cooperate with them?
So here's the cool thing, is that we've done so many shows together. I mean, talk about the love affair. Just for fun, tonight when you get home, go on Google and type in Nile Rodgers, Earth, Wind & Fire's Getaway, and you'll see me as a teenager. We worship Earth, Wind & Fire. So last year I was stricken with cancer, and I don't miss shows. I don't care how sick I am, I will go out and do the show. But I was so sick, the doctor made me stay in the hospital, and the guys from Earth, Wind & Fire went out and did the Chic show for me. I was lying in bed. It was... The love was, I was lying in bed crying, and all the nurses were around me. And I was going, I want to be there. And they're like out on stage, aw, freak out.
Verdeen taking over during the Bernard role.
No. Jerry was playing bass, but, you know, half of the band was out there. Tonight, Verdeen and I, we're challenging each other who's going to have the flyest clothes. Because that's our thing. He and I, we always say, like, okay, who's wearing the best outfit? So we actually wound up driving up together, and we walked up. So I was wearing that and this by a new African designer. And they were like, damn, nah, that's really cool. I said, well, you know, I had to come in because I knew Verdeen was going to, like, top me. And then all the guys in the band looked at me and said, no, we're all going to top you. So you let me know which artist looks better tonight after the show.
Do you want to say last few words about the album, and then we'll bring this to a close?
So, the new album is very much in the tradition of a Chic album. A Chic album follows a certain formula. This new album is conceptually our new show, but in today's world, most people have never seen us, so we can't go out and just do all brand new songs. They go, like, damn, what happened to, you know? We have to play songs that we know. And the thing is that because my life has taken an incredibly wonderful turn, when I met David Bowie in 1982, I started co-composing with a lot of other people. So when you are a composer, you're the most anonymous person in the world, right? Like if somebody as big as Bruno Mars wrote a hit record for somebody, most people don't know that Bruno wrote the song. Look at how many songs Prince wrote for other artists and people wouldn't know. So because I'm a composer and I'm proud of what I do, we play songs that I've written for other artists and with other artists. Like we do Let's Dance. I always go, damn, what if I did two Bowies? I mean, I did 5 records with Bowie. I mean, come on. But we only do one song because I've done so many records with artists that fortunately have been hits. We only get to do one Madonna song, one Bowie song, it's a fun show. We have a good time, man.
And we will see you on the Nile stage.
Yeah,
Nile Rodgers.
Yeah.
Please thank him for being here, and thank all of you for being here as well.
Let's Dance, the 15th studio album by the legendary and late David Bowie, co-produced by Chic's Nile Rodgers, released in April of 1983. Before we leave you today, let's hear a little bit more music from the new recording out today featuring Nile Rodgers and Chic. The album's called It's About Time. Here is Till the World Falls featuring Muramasi, Kosha, and Vic Mensa. New music from Nile Rodgers and Chic, and we thank him so much for letting us record that brilliant conversation from the 2018 North Sea Jazz Festival with the author Ashley Kahn. If you haven't already, get the show and subscribe to it automatically on iTunes and Stitcher, and if you feel inclined, make a contribution to WBGO. On our website at wbgo.org, there you can listen to the show as well. Follow us on social media, The Checkout from WBGO on Facebook, at Checkout Jazz, that's the Twitter handle. Hit me up on Instagram, at Simon Rettner. A huge special thanks to our production assistant, Anthony Nieves. The Checkout is a production of WBGO Newark. And I'm Simon Rettner. Thanks for checking us out.